Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, we are doing part two of our interview with Lady Michelle Renouf of London. We had a very good conversation with her last week, and we learned a lot. And tonight, I'm going to ask her, I am asking her about her visit to Tehran very recently, and because she knows more about it than I do, I'm just going to let her continue from here on. Welcome again, Lady Renouf.
Hello, Caroline, and hello, listeners. Nice to be back.
Thank you. Very nice to have you back. I need to remind them a little bit about you, but I think they have probably already read about it on our program page from last week, so you're very much in the news, connected with our Holocaust revisionists, and you're also a filmmaker and have done quite a few films and are currently doing films. You've had quite an outstanding career, and now you are continuing doing outstanding things, and you have a fairly good relationship, or would you say a close relationship, actually, with President Ahmadinejad in Iran.
Well, I'm proud to say, Carolyn, that I do have a friendly relationship with President Ahmadinejad, whom I admire enormously, because he is a man who speaks the whole political truth bravely, and therefore he's an outstanding statesman, and we don't have a rival for him in the West, I'm afraid. I sadly have to say that, but Nevertheless, I think we could also learn a great deal from Khomeini's revolution of 1979. Now, I'm not an Islamist, but I certainly think we have a lot to learn from Islam. I don't say that I wish to see, because I don't wish to see the crossover of our nations that are either psychologically Christian or psychologically Islamic. I don't believe that multi-faith it can be anything but feeble nonsense. Either people believe they know truth or they don't in spiritual terms. But I do think there's a great deal to be learned from Islam because it came later than Christianity, and it is very informative on something we all need to understand, which is about usury and the power of the international monetary system, which is actually promoting the concept of greed is good. And actually, you yourself did a wonderful program on the banking system that I very much admired and learned a lot from myself, actually, in consequence. And really, last week, we were talking about what I would call one arm of the pincer movement of our predator that has us in its swindle speak. And that arm was about creating and controlling the narrative as per advertising and giving us false packaging and false definitions in its terms, which confound and confuse us. And secondly, it also augments that confusion by creating and controlling the international usury, where governments get into enormous debt, war debt, and in consequence lose their sovereignty to the usurer who's lent them money to fight inter-Gentile wars for which neither side have ever won anything.
Yes.
only the predator does, and yes. Also for the arms industry. So World War One and World War Two are horrific examples of two intergentile wars where we killed off our best and bravest people, and only the predator who lent the money and schmoozed us into being vain and greedy enough to want to fall prey to mispackaged ideas that prompted wars between us, and we were hugely the losers, not least because we've lost our bravest people. That's why, unfortunately, we have very few people who are willing to go against the, mm-hmm. the seemingly invincible swindle speak that we are told all the time.
Yeah, let me interject here that I think and it comes home to me again and again how we have been our Western people have been convinced over the last 30, 40 years, and mostly in the last 20 years, and mostly of that in the last 10 years, it keeps growing, that we must be involved in the stock market. We must be investing in these markets, and we must be focusing and worrying and concerned about them all the time. I tell you, it is enough to make a person a nervous wreck because yes. They're so uncontrollable, and we know who's in control of them. So,
yes.
But it is just promoted and promoted, and most people believe if they have any money at all, they must put it into these investments, and then we are focused on this all the time, or too much of the time.
It's
not focused on things that would make our life more pleasant and pleasurable.
Yeah, that's right, and we are actually so dominated by a cultural ethos that is so robbing us of what I think are things that make people feel good in a common sense way, rather than in a sort of myth-addling, as I would call it, and sort of opiate kind of a way, really, where we are looking for therapies in things rather than simply looking for things that make sense to us in our terms of self-embetterment in virtuous terms. I think people need more than greed and vanity. Humans yes. have a capacity for something higher than greed and vanity and these infantile things that we grew out of, hopefully, as we got out of the childish stage of being greedy and being self-centered. And we always admire the person who is able to rise above greed and vanity to show us a better example of how to be in the world and how to relate in the world. And I believe common sense is to be valued. I am very opposed to this idea of disdaining ordinary people and their ordinary ability to decide what is good and what is not good. And now we're given a very fuzzy idea of being able to say this is right and this is wrong, when common sense tells us what is culprit and what is victim. We know these things, but we are being deliberately confused and misdirected to look at things that are not valuable to us instead of enjoying things that really are, like seeking the truth.
And you believe that that the leaders of Iran actually offer a good vision of this. Is that right?
Yes, I do indeed. Yes, I do indeed, Carolyn, because, as I say, I'm not an Islamist, but what I do say is the things that I have read that Imam Khomeini, who led the revolution in Iran in 1979, and after all, if he can do it without the funds to overthrow a predator that had taken over Iran, and because the Shah was very much in cahoots, unfortunately, with the pro-Zionist aspects of America, and this greed is good ethos that we are surrounded with every day in our press and our media and all of these influences in us. Imam Khomeini stood against that. He was against usury. He was against this infiltrating of Zionist American values. And he succeeded in overthrowing the Shah and keeping the revolution going. And since his death, it is still being substantiated and held up extremely well by its current president of Iran, Dr. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And I regard this man as a wonderful example of a role model for all of us, because he says, as I believe, that the head of the SXPX, the Society of Traditional Christianity, should do, but doesn't, that when sanctions or criticism is put against Iran, the president says, it will not alter our scrupulous attitude toward ethics and behavior. It will not dictate to us terms out of fear. We will not be dictated to by Zionist American forces. And I think that the SXPX, from the discussion we had last time about the Bishop Williamson, should similarly stand up against what might be termed sanctions, i.e. bad publicity, and say we don't care what bad publicity pro-Zionist press wants to put out. We will substantiate our idea of what we think are the true values and the historical truth so that we can have international justice. And this is what I would like to see Bishop Fellay, who is the head of this traditional Roman Catholic brotherhood called SXPX, doing instead of actually being willing to sacrifice the only Christian bishop, as far as I can see, who actually stands up for the warnings that are in Christianity against usury and against the deceivers that we see around us governing our countries and swindling us in foolish definitions.
Exactly.
And mispackaged ideas.
Yes, I think that most people would like to see that. I really do. I think people would stand behind, would back up these men, if knowing that they're standing on their beliefs and their principles. It's not really to do with the Holocaust, not in this case. It's to do with their religion, and their religion is still respected. So why do they feel they have to give way on their religion? I find this very troublesome, very, very distressing.
Well, I do too, Carolyn, and I really think that we have to come to understand that what is termed the Holocaust, whatever the Holocaust was or was not, in scientific factual terms, as opposed to the Hollywood version of this episode of history, whatever it was, certainly it has zero to do with the founding policies of Israel. Israel has no moral right to exist. It never has, and it never will, because half a century before World War II, indeed when Adolf Hitler was aged 8, Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Jewish state, indeed he wrote the Jewish state, and his diaries tell us that the intention, which is with us today, it's a blueprint that he wrote in 1895-96. Mm-hmm. And then they first announced it in their first International Zionist Congress of 1897. As I say, half a century before World War II, so that whatever happened in World War II is irrelevant to the anti-Gentile policies of the intended state, the Jewish state of Israel. It was to disappear, was the euphemism that Herzl used, the entire population of Palestine, the indigenous people, the innocent, indigenous, peace-loving Palestinians, were to be genocided one way or another by terror, mostly to get them to flee, in order that the population could be completely repopulated by Jews. Now, there is no moral right, and there's certainly no ethical, religious, spiritual right, such as anybody else would accept, other than a person who wants to believe in an infantile, selfish, greedy, absurd God that wants to kill innocent people an imposture of greed and vanity. That's
what people say now. What they say now, Lady Renouf, is that, well, we can't go backwards. What's done is done, and so we have to start from where we are. This is the typical answer that they give when you say this was wrong
indeed
from the beginning. They say, well, it may have been, but now it's done, and so where do we go from here? These people are there.
That's right, Caroline.
You can't kick them out.
That's the exact weasel argument that we get from people who like to take the line of it appeals to people who like to take the line of least resistance, not to take the joy and pleasure of looking into something seriously and applying common sense to it. All people can apply common sense to this specious argument. If something was based on non-ethics and immoral, there is no point in U.S. taxpaying people being conned into supporting the existence of the Israeli Zionist entity in Palestine on the strength, as it's put, which of course is totally dragon strength, that there is a moral right for these people to be there due to what is called the Holocaust. And that is basically what it comes down to. People still may say, oh, well, it may have been a bad concept in the beginning, but nevertheless, 50 years later, these poor victims still deserve this state. Well, first of all, there's no moral right, as I've just explained, in the outset, in the founding of it. And that immoral right still pertains today and is still relevant in the very ethos of Israel.
Yes.
Because in 1945, at the end of World War II, whatever is the truth about what happened to Jews in World War II, whatever is the case, in 1945, there was no longer any political impediment to stop European Jews from going immediately without any difficulty, and certainly safely, and certainly peacefully, to their first Jewish homeland, which is called Birbijan. It's the capital of an area called the Jewish Autonomous Region. In fact, in all but name, it is the Jewish Republic. And I can only ask our listeners if they will look to my website. It's a Common Sense Campaign Moral and Morale Rearmament Campaign called www.jewishrepublic.com, where the case for the first homeland option for Jews I put, as opposed to the second option, which is the current charity state of Israel, which is both bandit and rogue. It was in its inception, and it is still the same today. It is in illegal state because it hasn't established its borders, therefore it's already illegal for not establishing its borders, even though its flag tells us what the borders are, because the concept is from the Nile to the Euphrates. That's what those two blue lines represent, so that they don't want just Palestine. They want all of that area in their imposture, as if this is a prophecy come true, where it's clearly a profiteering come true. So, A, there is no moral right, no moral argument for the existence of the charity state of Israel, supported only by the ignorant circumstance of the American taxpayers funding a state that they don't understand as being something that's quite contrary to the Constitution of America, whereby Jeffersonian America said, we will not interfere with other states We will look after our own people and mind our own business. And unfortunately, the foreign policy of the pro-Zionist foreign policy of America means that instead of the money going on the needs of the American people, it goes to the needs of a bandit state that's actually totally immoral and furthermore does not need to exist. It has no moral right to exist and has no need to exist.
Yes, because, well, Lady Renault, if you would tell us about how you came to make this last trip to Tehran and how you came to speak about Birobidzhan there, and then tell us more about Birobidzhan.
Yes, well, it was on this occasion, I had been to Tehran before 2 years ago when they had the Holocaust Review International Congress where everybody could come and give all sides of the debate. So this year they had a call for papers for the fourth international conference on Imam Khomeini and foreign policy, and it was about international justice. So I sent in my paper, which was termed Achieving Justice in the International System, the Role of the UN and the Privileged Veto, and they liked my paper, and I was invited to present it there, and that was on the 2nd of June last month. The following day, I was invited, as were 1,000 international guests, to be present at the presidential headquarters in Tehran on the 3rd of June, and there I was asked impromptu to address President Ahmadinejad and the assembled audience for 5 or 10 minutes. And I took that opportunity of explaining to President Ahmadinejad, sitting about 4 feet from me whilst I stood at the podium, to explain to him that there was this Jewish autonomous region that no one knows much about, if they've ever heard of it at all. I've certainly never heard him refer to it, and that it's something that I believe solves the entire problem in the Middle East and in the world, because we don't need the headquarters for international Zionism anywhere, actually. We just need peace for all races to live in a reasonable way among others. So I was explaining to him that Birobidzhan was an area given to Jews in 1928 by Stalin, and it was not an anti-Semitic act, as many Jews like to point to make out. Actually, this was not true. Stalin gave all the ethnicities that comprised the Soviet Union, each of them, their autonomous region. And the Jews were given the autonomous region called after its the capital, Birobidzhan. It is actually the size of Switzerland. And we never hear, I think I can say never hear, in our syndicated international press a peep about the fact that there is a Jewish republic in Olmut name, the size of Switzerland, on the border in Russia of China with Russia. And there it is. It's been there since 1928. It was peacefully established without displacing any indigenous people. And no anti-Semitic, as they, in quotes, acts have ever been perpetrated against any Jews in the Jewish Autonomous Region. And the only time that one hears anything, and you have to search the internet very carefully to find any reference to it in any newspapers, and it is only in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency or one of those kinds of very limited circulation Jewish press, where you have a very uncommon reference to it. And there they always describe it as a district. And what district is the size of Switzerland? So this thing is kept very much under wraps. And in fact, recently the Jewish Telegraphic Agency have explained in an article where all of those regions that Stalin gave to the ethnicities that comprised the enormous Soviet Union, they have all become republics, but the Jewish autonomous region has declined to announce itself as a republic.
We have to take our break now, Lady Renouf. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is very interesting, and we will come back and start in right where we left off. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
And the market for predator drones is expanding rapidly these days, and although their use results in death and destruction, operating these robots is sometimes likened to playing a video game. RT correspondent Guyan Chijikan has a story. Listen.
They come out of the blue.
I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming.
A drone is 10 times cheaper than a fighter jet. It requires no pilot, so there are no troop deaths to explain. It's the perfect weapon for covert CIA operations in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan.
If things go wrong, you can deny it always.
And things do go wrong. Studies by independent international experts suggest that for every militant killed, as many as 15 civilians also die. There's no way of getting exact numbers. The CIA keeps its drones program under wraps. But the United Nations and other international organizations question the legality of the extensive use of the weapon.
It becomes different when you come to a sort of undeclared war with organizations which, like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and you go after persons, you say, we say they are terrorists. But who has proven that the persons you're actually targeting are the terrorists? They're not in uniform.
But humanitarian concerns seem to be doing little to dampen surging international demand for drones, also known as unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. The military appetite is such that the market is expected to grow to a staggering $55 billion in 10 years from now.
With the advances in technology, they depersonalize warfare, and so therefore you have people more willing to use them, and you have people that don't understand the consequences, because the people who are flying the drones are not on the battlefield, they're not in the plane, they're thousands of miles away, and when they cause destruction, they don't feel it.
Here in Washington, D.C. supper, the CIA drone operator wakes up in the morning, kisses his family goodbye, comes to the office, and shoots at targets thousands of miles away from here and goes back home. No risk whatsoever. Specialists say the whole operation reminds a video game. The question many ask is, if it is so easy and convenient, will the powers be tempted to wage more wars in the future?
If war is cheap, then why not use it a bit more? Especially against, you know, smaller countries and organizations that in other cases you would try to sit around with the table with and talk it over.
Simon Vetterman has produced a research report on drones for the European Parliament. Among his concerns are the consequences of terrorists getting hold of such weapons, a scenario some might liken to real life but deadly robot wars. Demonstrators outside CIA headquarters at the start of the year protested against indiscriminate killings by unmanned weaponry. They say that rather than winning wars, drones merely make more enemies by killing mostly innocent people, fueling rather than quelling insurgency. Ganesh Chagan, RT, Washington, D.C.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I am with Lady Michelle Renouf, who has been telling us about Birobidjan during this program and her visit to Tehran and her speech in front of President Ahmadinejad. So as we left off, you were telling us how that Birobidjan had chosen, the people there do not want to have it known as a Jewish republic, which is what it was set up to be. And why is that?
Well, it would seem, actually, even judging by some of the remarks that are made in the Jewish press itself, and the Jewish press is the only time you'll ever hear about Birobidjan, the capital of the Jewish autonomous region, but they actually do confess that it's been too delicate, as they put it, because they love to use euphemism, too delicate to allow the Jewish autonomous region to be officially designated as the Jewish Republic, although they do refer to it as a Jewish Republic, because this would tread on the toes of Israel. This would be insensitive. This would be too delicate. I.e., it would be risky to allow the possibility of alerting and raising the awareness of the totally unaware world that there exists an area the size of Switzerland in the world where Jews have total autonomy, where the language, the first language, has always been officially Yiddish, mm-hmm. and where the education in the schools always promotes the Jewish culture. And the signs, the street signs, and so everything is in Yiddish. So the concept that there is a first Jewish homeland, it's been there since 1928. It celebrates its 82nd peaceful existence. People say, oh, well, they had many ideas. They had the ideas of a homeland in the Crimea. They had Uganda. They had Kenya. They had here and there and there. These were ideas. But Birobidjan, the Jewish Autonomous Region, the Jewish Republic, is not an idea. It's an extant, existing, real, viable, peaceful, ever-safe, rational, reasonable, comfortable, fertile, and rich area to accommodate Jews who ever wanted to have a totally Jewish environment. It is an environment for them and remains available to them. Admittedly, there are not so many Jews there now because, of course, they were seduced to build up the demographics in Israel. But nevertheless, this first homeland for Jews is there. There was no need for them to have a second homeland in Palestine. There was certainly no right, as I was saying, at any time, moral right for international Jewry to pirate Palestine, and there still isn't. So as I presented it to President Ahmadinejad and his invited audience of 1,000 international guests, let us talk and make the world aware that the charity state of Israel, the bandit criminal state that chronically culls the Palestinians as and when it wishes, has no right and no need to exist. It can be dismantled, and the Jews who wish to live in a Jew-only safe homeland, the option is readily to hand. We don't have to listen anymore to this farce of one state or two state. Let us stop the one state or two state nonsense, because that only goes on, as far as I can see, because people don't know that there is this reasonable, rational, common sense, peaceful option.
Yes,
that gives
that
everyone a fair deal.
It's reasonable and rational, but it doesn't fit in with what they're after. And it's true that Stalin, tried to settle the Russian Jews, the Jews that were in Russia, in this place, mm-hmm. starting in 1928. And it's been going through this and that over the years. But currently on the internet, it says that the current population of this Jewish autonomous region is 200,000, which is not very much, and that only a few thousand are Jewish. So there's lots of room there. But it also says that hundreds of Jews are leaving every year for Israel and other places. So,
but they also say that they're coming back. They also say that many of them are already coming back because they're not happy in Israel. They can see Israel is not what it's promoted. Many Jews don't want to be part of this ugly rogue state and so on. But coming back to your point that very often is raised, well, it's there now. Israel is there. Whether it's right or wrong, it's there. It can't be dismantled. Well, my argument would be, yes, it can be dismantled because, as Paul Craig Roberts recently pointed out quite rationally and reasonably, who is one of your best common sense speakers, he can easily be looked up by your listeners, by our listeners on the internet for what he says about the rogue state. It's only there because America supports Israel. The Zionist entity would not be there but for the taxpaying Americans. Without the taxpaying Americans supporting this charity state, Israel is a charity state.
It is.
It's entirely supported. So if every American taxpayer says, no, I don't like the foreign policy where all of my money is going to support criminals to kill innocent people instead of supporting the building of the dams in New Orleans, my health schemes, my building of schools, and all of the things that we think our taxpaying is for, Israel ceases to exist anyway. But all humans have a right to exist safely. We don't kill off our predators. We simply put them somewhere sensibly so that they are not interfering with our own safety. Israel is making the world unsafe for everyone, including the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But this does not need to be the case. If they were helped to go to their own Jewish republic and they compensated every Palestinian for the last 100 years that have suffered in consequence of the longest tragedy in the 20th century, which is called the Nakba, the catastrophe that happened to the Palestinians, which is far longer, far greater, and far more distressing because it's ongoing and happening before our eyes right to the present day, all of the misery of the Middle East would be solved.
Let me say this.
Fairly.
I think the people of the world are pretty, well, maybe I'm wrong. I think that they're pretty well convinced that the Palestinians are being treated in a terrible way and something needs to be done about this. What is the approach that needs to be taken because of the powers that be seem to want it this way?
Well, what I would recommend, Carolyn, is that the 191 nations that comprise the UN, if they were made aware of the first Jewish homeland, Jewish Republic option, they would have a non-so-called anti-Semitic argument to make, to put into, for the first time probably in terms of this international injustice, a UN resolution that calls for the dissolution of the pirate charity rogue state of Israel and promotes the existence of the Jewish Republic.
But the UN route never works. I mean, going through the UN never seems to bring about anything.
Well, you're right, Carolyn, because that was the topic of my paper in Tehran last month, the privileged veto at the UN, because I pointed out to President Ahmadinejad on that same little speech I made, which is available, by the way, at my website, www.jewishrepublic.com. You will find it. I made the speech without notes, but the transcript is there, and you can see what I said there. And very likely in the American Free Press, you may actually even learn what the President Ahmadinejad said to me personally, which even the Jewish police blog don't know. That's another aspect you can learn when you visit my website. But, oh, so many threads I give you, and I lose track of where I'm going with so many points to make to you.
What you said about the UN veto.
Ah, yes, the UN.
Why?
Yes, exactly right. Thank you. Yes, I was saying that even though the UN is specious, because it's based on the specious Nuremberg trials of 1945 and 46, which five of your U.S. Supreme Court judges at the time said was specious and it was a lynch mob. Actually, the UN is based on these specious laws that were created in consequence of the Nuremberg trials, which were absolutely went against all international sense of justice because they used hearsay, not eyewitnesses, and they used testimony forced by torture from people. So both of those things are totally specious. And the third aspect is that you cannot have the person who's bringing the charges sitting in judgment on the case. It's against natural justice. So all aspects in terms of the factors for judging justice were totally illegitimate in the Nuremberg trials, and therefore so, of course, is the UN. However, it's possible, unlike the European Union, where it has no allowance for criticizing it at all, the UN does actually have the possibility of putting a resolution in there to criticize its conduct, because it Article 327 says that those who are party to a dispute must excuse themselves from voting. But every vote that is about the Israel is vetoed. America conducts a privileged veto for it. So it's possible to use the UN to bring it to some sort of scrupulous conduct. So if 191 countries could see the sense of the Jewish Republic as opposed to Israel, then there is a chance that common sense could prevail, because it's not anti-Semitic to actually propose.
But it will be presented as anti-Semitic, and we know that all
it
of
will
these
be.
People cave,
yes.
cave in at that. So I don't
it
see.
Will be presented. Yes, you're right, Carolyn. It will be presented, but it's easily disputed, because
yes,
if
but people don't even
it.
have the what you call it to dispute
yes.
it. You know, they don't have what it takes. It's sickening.
Well, I think this is where
we need to go to the source. Why I do? I go to the source of the problem, which, as you have already mentioned, is the Nuremberg trials, which is the World War II yes. official account, and including the Holocaust.
Yes.
That's where all of this is sourced. Of course, you can even go back
yes.
further than that, that brought this on. But, you know, as long as this is in place, as long as we can't question this, I don't think we're going to make any progress on any other fronts.
Well,
you disagree?
Well, Carolyn, I'm happy to say I disagree with you, because I think that the revelation of the Jewish Republic will break this situation, which otherwise you're correct and it stands. But with the actual existence of a Jewish homeland, as opposed to this rogue state, gives the public the option that it didn't know it had, and in terms of the one state, two-state argument. If people knew that there was a third option, which is makes sense, it's all round humane, and it only takes the taxpayers of America to stop being willing to support the imposture of Israel, then this thing can be actually this myth-addledom that people are under, this inertia that people feel because they can't, they don't think they can, they're up against the seemingly invincible, it's absolutely dispelled once the Jewish entity is no longer there to make people believe it's a God-sent idea that Israel exists. When people see that there's another option that is also both humane and feasible, they can just fly there and there they are in their homeland. It's a viable, it's rich in minerals, it's rich in timber, it's rich in natural resources. The Jewish autonomous region is a viable homeland.
Well, it's viable if somebody just went there. How would they live? How would they make their living? I mean, is it that strong of a government in place and infrastructure and so on?
Well, how did the first Americans manage when they went how did anyone manage?
They don't expect to have pioneers.
Okay, so that's what happened when the Zionists pirated Palestine.
Yes,
they also had to build up, and they had all of the American, they say, these
but
amazing
they had
people.
International Jewry behind them, whereas I don't, you, if
well,
you
they,
don't have
well, they still will.
Behind
well, they still
people.
Will. Well, they still, actually, American Jewry were very much behind the Birobidzhan in the beginning. It was only when Israel was forcing the building up of the demographics of the Jews to come to Israel that the population was depleted. There were 37,000 Jews in 1937 in Birobidzhan. They were nabbed by Israel to build up its demographics, and so were many other countries. Iraq, for example, the Iraqi Jews were actually subject to Zionist. It's documented that Zionist anti-Semitism, as it was called, actually forced and terrified the Iraqi Jews to flee to Palestine. So there's enormous pressure there. But the point of the exercise is that the power over us of these people who cause people to feel inertia, feel that they are powerless, will be completely dissolved and dispelled once they are once people know of this existence, that there's no need for Israel and this criminality and misery, and there's no right of it.
All right, so you're calling for a massive campaign to educate people about Birobidzhan. You have
moral and morale rearmament. That's what I'm calling for. Common sense, peaceful, reasonable rearmament. And it can be done simply by the taxpayers of America waking up to the existence of the Jewish homeland and becoming aware of the fact that they can insist that their taxpaying money is not paid any longer to support the rogue state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope people will go to your website, www.birobidzhan.com.uk, .co.uk, or the same website also, Jewish Republic, isn't it?
JewishRepublic.com.
Yes, and
JewishRepublic.com.
People need to read about it, so otherwise that's the first step, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Tell us in the last part that we have here about your films, and maybe that will include some films about Birobidzhan. But and how people can get your films.
Well, I make non-profit making educational films available through my website, so that people get the chance to see what is democratically right and proper, i.e. the other side of an historical debate. And there you can find the on DVD and CDs. You can order them, and I'll send them to you, to your readers and listeners. so that people become aware of what debates there have been, because most of these things are only allowed on fringe media and sort of somewhat obscure media. But the internet is our great blessing in our lives, because we can have, we can bypass the privileged veto, and we can hear the other side of historical debates and ideas, which, of course, your wonderful program permits and is part of.
Do you have reduced rates for large orders or anything like that?
All you need to do is to write to me via my email address. There's an email address there called dvdorders@tellingfilms.co.uk, or just contact me through the website and ask me whatever you like, and I shall try and accommodate what is called for and what anybody needs. But the main thing is for people to link my website, so the campaign, the moral and morale rearmament campaign, becomes a familiar to people.
Yes,
and I believe that just by knowing about this option, we will lift the seemingly invincible predator from off our back, and the world will become, again, in line with the four classical virtues that is the basis of the best of the West, and indeed it's the basis of Iran. And we can then appreciate the warnings that were given to us by Islam and Christianity against international usury and against the rabbinical deceivers, and then we have a better chance for international justice via having historical truth, which is the prerequisite for any international justice. It's never too late to make good what has been done that has been unjust.
Yes, I don't want to sound like a negativist, because I do believe that anything is possible, and there's way too much pessimism and way too much people saying, "Oh, you know that will never happen. This, you can't do it. We're, you know, they're too powerful, and this is the way it's going to be from now on." And you know, I'm glad I'm going to die soon, and you know, all of this because you know, this world isn't going to be worth living in. And but this is just not the right attitude to take. And
look, we've had a wonderful legal victory that nobody ever dreamt of. We have kept Tobin out of being thrown in a dungeon in Germany. We've kept the Bishop Williamson being thrown, and we've kept even more than those two gentlemen. We have kept Britain from being subject to debate denial. That's what this is all about. Debate denial. We have rescued English law from colluding with debate denial. And that has been a major victory for freedom of source critical inquiry and opinion, which is the very basis of the Jeffersonian America that we honor. I keep saying when I was in Iran, please don't chant down with America. Chant down with Zionist America, because our countries are occupied by pro-Zionist ethos, which is totally anti-Gentile and against all human and humane common sense. Let us restore a Jeffersonian America everywhere.
I'm all for that. And Lady Renouf, we have run out of time, and you have brought us to a very beautiful ending. And I hope that people take all of this to heart. And I thank you very much for being my guest. I hope we will talk again. And would you have any final few words for our listeners? Like five words.
Yes, Carolyn Yeager, you are one of my heroes. Because you get it out there to the people, and you do a tremendously great job.
Thank you very, very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.